presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Welcome, everybody, to episode 64 of First Years, and we have some special guests today. Creating Magic is discussing chapters 34 and 35 with us, so I have Danny and Paula with me. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm so excited to have you guys here.
We are very excited to be here.
Did not realize what chapters you had given me, and I was not prepared to be emotional because of the chapters you gave
me. Yeah, sorry about that.
I know, this is like crying homework. I was like, what? What is this?
It was too big for me to do alone, and I was like, listen, if I have to suffer, other people have to suffer with me, and you guys are the chosen ones today.
I still remember reading it for the first time.
Yeah.
Same. I read these chapters, I think, on Christmas morning.
And oh, my God. Like,
very sad about it.
That hurts.
Merry Christmas. That sounds awful.
Yeah, it was a thing. And I remember my dad being like, why are you crying? It's just a book. And I was like, listen, this is not just a book. And this is not just a character. This is everything.
Agreed. At the time, he was one of my favorite adult characters.
He is a good one. But before we get into our feels, we have a lot to discuss about everything that happens and the Department of Mysteries and all of the rooms that we see. I do have to say that at the beginning of these chapters, I do love that Luna was like, oh, it's easy, and just like helps the other characters onto the Thestrals. And she's like, this isn't a big deal at all. What the hell, guys?
A Ravenclaw represent.
Absolutely. But one of the things I did want to ask was, okay, so I talked last episode about how Harry didn't really want any of these people to come along and was kind of being a jerk about how he would not have chosen this crew to come with him to the ministry. So what do we think it says about Harry that he really didn't want them to come along, but ultimately it's so necessary for him to have backup on this mission? And what does it say about Luna, Neville, and Ginny, who insist on coming along anyway and making a difference?
I mean, to me, Silver Trio is above Golden Trio all the way. That is, for me, that it meant more that he didn't choose them and they were there. Because these are your friends. These are the people who are, they're showing up. You have nobody. These people are choosing to show up for you.
Literally. I felt like, I was kind of like, Harry, like, what is your deal? Like, these are the people that are like, no, we're standing by you and we're coming with you. And like, why would you judge the people that are like really going to have your back?
I think Harry also inherently has a problem on the whole.
End sentence.
Yes. But like, period. He never trusts his friends. Like, how many times does like Hermione and Ron since book one have to be like, dude, you're not going alone?
I know. And you know, and I almost think that speaks to, I think especially in this book where like, Harry really is sort of left to his own devices, especially in the beginning of the book. Like, after going through all of the trauma at the end of Goblet of Fire, spends the summer alone. There's a bunch of secrets being kept from him. We find out that Dumbledore is extremely unreliable now in this book, right? And so I almost wonder if it stems from the fact that Harry has, at least in this book, been like, okay, I've been left to my own devices. And so he maybe has learned to rely on himself a little bit too much when there are people literally right in front of him that are willing to help out.
I think it couldn't even go back further than that. Like, he had no friends growing up. Like, was book one, they specifically say that he did not have friends because Dudley made sure he didn't.
Yeah.
So he's never had to rely on other people. And so maybe in his mind, he's expecting the people he thinks would be the best people, when in actuality, it's the people that are loyal to him and not necessarily the best at curses or spells, but it's the people that stand up and will make sure that they show up. Because when it comes down to it, you want the people that will show up, not the ones that just are great at magic.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and I think also, like, I mean, we see that they're good at magic. It's actively, like, stated that Neville has progressed beautifully. Like, you know, I think in, which proves that in the right environment, Neville is not bad at magic at all. He just needed the correct teacher. And so, yeah, but I also think, like, Harry, I mean, Ron and Hermione have always been with Harry, you know, through, for, like, from book one onward, right? And so I do also think that maybe it also stems from, like, the fact that, like, even though the proof is there that, like, he has people to back him up, you know, he still doesn't necessarily feel like he has them. You're right. His assumption is, I still have to do this on my own.
And maybe even to the point that, like, Luna, Ginny, and Neville had no idea what was going on. Like, they didn't even know he was related to Sirius Black. But they just shut up. You also invited two Neville stands on here, so we will always fight and protect always. Neville at all costs. There will be no anti-Neville on this episode. Yes,
there will be no Neville slander allowed.
There's no Neville slander ever on this podcast.
I'm like, we cannot. I hadn't read it in a long time. So when I read the two chapters, I was like, my God, I had, like, so much movie in my head, you know, that, like, you forget, like, how things actually happen. So it was, like, the wand breaking, like, all the stuff that you're like, oh, my God, his broken nose. I was like, oh, my poor Neville.
Yep.
I mentally went the other way and went, oh, my gosh, I can't wait to see this on a TV show. Because, like, we missed so many scenes.
There's, I know,
so really cool rooms.
Yeah, that is one of the things. I think that's also why Order of the Phoenix is probably my least favorite film out of all of them, is mainly because they do not do the Department of Mysteries justice. Which I get, like, this book is very long. It's very hard to fit into, like, you know, movie form. But yeah, there's just so much that's missing.
My TED talk to this day will stay and remain is that when they do a book series, they should be doing two parts of the middle book. I think 5 should have been 2 parts, 7 could have been 1 part. Hunger Games, same situation. That middle book is where all the meat is, and that should have been the 2-parter, not the last book. But they stretch out the last book all the time rather than the one in the middle that has so much information that I think would have been a better service to the films had they split movie 5 into 2 parts rather than movie 7.
That's a good point. I think I could stand behind that, that theory for sure. One of the other things that I thought of while they were traveling to London is that I had the flashback of Chamber of Secrets, where Harry and Ron take the flying car from London to Hogwarts and get spotted by several people. Were they not, did no muggles look up and see, like, 6 people just straddling nothing in the middle of the sky?
I go with it was nighttime. And hopefully they had some coverage there. Like, the Ford Anglia, it was bright, sunny, blue car, headlights, big thing. I don't know. Or maybe did, like, the invisibility of the Thestrals also hide them because of the wings? Like, maybe there wasn't as much body mass to see because of how big the creature was. And unless you've seen someone die, you can't see them. And then if you have seen someone die, they're black, so they're blending into the sky.
That's
because it's nighttime.
Because it's nighttime.
But I thought the same thing. I was like, Oh, this is, like I said, I had not read it in so long that when I read it, I was like, oh my God, are these people like invisible flying, like just their bodies? Like,
just, yeah, because I'm assuming that's what like Harry sees, right? If like, or not Harry, but like, I'm assuming that's what Hermione sees when Harry is on a Thestral, right? Because she can't see them. So it is interesting to like, you know, if, because most muggles, I guess, cannot see magical creatures, right? Although squibs can see dementors, possibly, depending on what side of the argument you fall on of whether Mrs. Fig was lying or not. But it is an interesting concept to think that, like, if the actual body of a Thestral is invisible, whether or not you could see through them to see the teenagers on top of them.
How do you explain that to somebody?
I don't know.
That's when you're just walking, like,
in the street.
We had one too many to drink. Next time we don't go with that alcohol version.
Maybe that's why they didn't get, like, you know, in trouble for breaking the statute of magical secrecy, is because someone looked up and was like, that can't be right.
I should have never had that Irish coffee today. Today was the wrong day. Adam.
Okay, so they do make it to London, apparently not spotted by any muggles. And I think we need to talk about this telephone box situation that's essentially the ministry's front desk. Like, okay, what actually tips, like, or trips the security system, I guess, of the ministry? Because I think it's hilarious that, like, they're given badges that say rescue mission.
Rescue mission.
But, like, will it let anyone in? Like, what reason would you have for it to, like, deny you entry into the ministry? Like, I don't think it's much of a security system at all.
And aren't there office hours? You would assume that the visitor's entrance would be closed. Like, the people that would need to access it in an emergency would be using the flu network, not the visitor's yes. entrance.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, you would think that it wouldn't just let you in.
And are no they all there. Inside this phone booth?
Yes,
with
they
Thestrals
are.
And all of them? Like,
not the Thestrals.
Not the Thestrals.
Okay, because I was like, are they in there too? Because when I read it, I was like, wait a second.
I think, like, they just let the Thestrals just wander the streets of London for a little while.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole, like, state your names.
See, but in my head, they have, like, Ron Dial. But in my head, I'm thinking of the park box, which is the rotary. So it's not just hitting numbers. It's a... hit the numbers, and they have all these people in this box.
They're like,
which we know that many people don't fit in that box, and he's trying to do the rotary phone is what my mental image was.
I don't even think three thin people fit in that box, much less six.
Definitely not.
How are you getting all these people in here?
They're just like, you know, they're just, like, patiently waiting for Ron to just finish dialing the number. And also, do you think Ron is able to, like, actually punch in the code because he sort of kind of learned how to use a telephone, like, earlier in the series?
Maybe.
No, I don't think he can. One, he's also, like, the lankiest of them. So he's, like, the one that has the least amount of, like, movability. Like, Ginny would have made sense, maybe, if she could figure out a phone. I feel like she's pretty smart, though. But, like, lanky Ron, who doesn't know how to do anything with Muggle technology, is dialing on the phone.
Yeah.
And then the badges come out where the change yes. would come out of. And so these badges are, like, smaller than a Post-it. Like, 1/4 of a Post-it. Like, and then they mentioned that they're in their robes.
Yeah.
Like, clip them to your robes. And I was like, oh, in the movie, they're not in their robes. So.
They're not. And, like, you know, but also, like, if they're that small, like, who yeah. is catching, like, exactly what the badge says?
I was like, what? When it said it shot it out, and then it describes that it came out of, like, basically the change slot, I was like, What size are these badges?
Just quarters.
Just quarters here. Let me see your badge.
So they're supposed to like get their badges and then like go like to the front desk security person, right? To like hand in their wand or whatever. There's no person at the security desk. Do we think that Voldemort got rid of the security person, or is there just no overnight security at the Ministry of Magic?
I think the Death Eaters dealt with the security person because they also have that line where they're like, it didn't look good that there wasn't a security person there.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's probably like a station there. And especially if the visitor's entrance is open 24/7.
Apparently.
I'm going with Death Eaters did something. Maybe he was knocked out underneath the desk.
I like knocked out underneath the desk rather than just like straight up murdered.
I just imagine them walking by and there's just like a foot sticking out. Like, he's asleep, sleeping spell.
He's taking a nap. Going
on. Gonna lose his job in a few hours when everyone shows up and truly hasn't done a thing.
The phone booth should lose the job.
In fact,
the phone booth does an awful job. They're like the first layer of security and they're just like spitting out badges.
We just need to know why you're here. We don't care if it's good or bad.
That's on the ministry. They're the ones that were like, phone booth, you operate 24/7. You're going to let a bunch of underage wizards in at like 9, 10 o'clock at night, maybe later.
Yep. I mean,
later. Maybe... they were flying those specials at night. So.
That's true. It's like 6 a.m. Yeah, and like, I mean, I guess this is why the ministry was so easy to infiltrate for Voldemort, because he could just walk right in. It's fine.
Voldemort probably asked. He said Voldemort and said to kill Harry Potter. Let him in.
Thank you for visiting. Please turn in your wand at the front desk.
Can you imagine him in the phone booth like, and doing the buttons?
Just the vibe, just as Voldemort here to murder his nemesis.
His little tiny badge. I'm sorry. I think for LeakyCon we should make tiny badges.
Wait, we should.
We rescue, but like so tiny.
They should be what you hand out for trading, and it needs to be like ridiculous things like for the reason people are there.
Bake sale.
Janitor replacing toilet paper.
Spell gone wrong.
Oh my god.
I like that idea a lot, actually. We should totally do that.
I'm on it.
Yes.
Podcast panel, we have the perfect place to give them out.
I love it.
I'm gonna come as a phone booth.
Yes. I love it. Love it so much.
Please do. That is actually a great cosplay idea.
So good. So we finally get to this door that Harry has been dreaming about since page one. We're finally here. Everything has led us to this point. And we have wandered about this door for hundreds and hundreds of pages. And we are finally here. And this is a huge moment for us. And it's a huge moment for Harry. But before we even touch the prophecy that we learned about in these chapters, we need to talk about each room that we experience in the Department of Mysteries. So room one has lamps hanging low on golden chairs. It's a rectangular room, which I noticed was a recurring theme. It's empty, save for desks and a glass tank of deep green water, which is big enough to swim in. And it has brains in it. And it says there's a number of brains in there. And I have to point out, like, we don't know, I guess, if I give the benefit of the doubt to these other characters, we don't know what types of brains they are. But I have to point out that no one except Hermione knows what a brain looks like, which I find really concerning. And at first I thought, well, okay, Hogwarts doesn't teach science, so maybe wizards don't know. But, like, Harry doesn't know either.
He went to public school.
He did.
Yeah, we know Hermione was at some advanced charter school.
I mean, yeah, but like, I don't know. Like, they just don't know what a brain looks like, I guess, unless it's not a human brain. But
hey, my kids are 7 and they know what a human brain looks like. And we're in Florida, so that should say a lot.
Yeah. So they'd be like, guys, it's clearly brains in this tank.
Yeah.
Okay, 15-year-olds. So, I mean, so let's just like talk about like this room and like what it represents, right? Because we learn like later on that there's like a time room. You know, we see the room that later on there's like the big fight where like Sirius falls through the veil. This one has like brains in it. So obviously, and like obviously the Department of Mysteries works on stuff that really can't be spoken about. So my first thought was like, what are they studying here? What are they developing here? I thought maybe they're like trying to understand thought. And you know how like a thought can like come, like sort of comes to life when you think of something. So maybe like when it attacks Ron, it's like thought coming to life. They're able to act on their own accord. The other thought I had was, is it memory? Do we think maybe this is the room where they developed the Pensieve?
That's deep.
Maybe it's
like my favorite magical item. So I didn't even think about that.
Maybe it's like wizard cryogenics, because then where are these brains coming from? And if they're magical, are they like former wizard brains who have all this knowledge that they're trying to figure out?
That is a great question, because like, yeah, we don't know if they're developing these brains, like, or were these brains that were like the wizards like decided to donate their body to science.
But they don't have science.
They don't have science, but whatever the equivalent.
Like the equivalent. But I'm like, well, it attacked Ron, so maybe it was like a former dark wizard brain, and they're trying to figure out why dark wizards are dark.
I like that theory too.
Just in my head, they look like human brains with jellyfish tentacles.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's got to be something. I mean, clearly, like the brain like attacks, right? So like this is not necessarily a safe room to be in, which like checks out for the Department of Mysteries. But it's just interesting to like think that it has to be something where it's either dangerous enough or important enough that not everybody can know about it, but it's important enough that like the ministry employs people to work on whatever it is.
I would get freaked out if I saw a pool of brains.
I'd be like, listen, Harry, I come with you this far, but I gotta go now.
But this is where I draw the line.
Do you think there are rooms in the Department of Mysteries that aren't dangerous? Like, are they just, do they have a room where they're like just researching pygmy puffs because they're mysterious little puff balls?
It's a padded room.
I would bet the pygmy puffs are in the magizoology department.
Agreed, but like, is there something that's like, because every room we've encountered are not safe rooms.
Very true.
Like, all of it is like some form of like, not necessarily evil or dark magic, but magic that can cause harm.
Well, I mean, the Room of Prophecies isn't necessarily a dangerous room, right? Like, it's only dangerous because the Death Eaters are there. I feel like you could have just like walked through that room and exited no problem.
But yes, you could exit it no problem, but it can contain information that could be dangerous.
Yes, very true.
For those that found. But then again, they can only touch the prophecy if they're one of the, you don't know, there's so many rules.
I know. So room 2 that we see is larger than room 1. It's dimly lit. It's also rectangular. In the center, there's a large stone pit 20 feet below. There are benches all around like an amphitheater. There's a raised stone dais in the center with an ancient archway, which is cracked and crumbling with a veil that looks like it has just been touched. And this is ultimately where we have like the final moment of these chapters. But I think it's interesting that we see it ahead of time. And I also think it's interesting that Harry feels so called to the Veil. So that's my first question about this room, is that, like, why does Harry feel so called to it while, like, Hermione doesn't, right? Is it because he's either A, physically closer to it, or B, like, abstractly closer to it from what he's experienced in life or what he's about to experience in the next chapter? The quote is, "The gently rippling veil intrigued him. He felt a very strong inclination to climb up the dais and walk through it." He can also hear whispering. So can Luna. It does not say if Neville can or not, which would, it would make sense if he did, because it would align with those who can see the Thestrals can also hear the voices. And another question is, why do we think, or what do we think it means that these voices are familiar enough to Harry that he thinks it's either Sirius or Ron? Like, those are both voices that he would be able to recognize without much thought, you know? So it wouldn't happen by accident. So why do these voices sound so familiar?
I remember, when, even back to, like, when I first read this book, I always equated it to, it was like the same people that could see Thestrals, and the voices that they hear are like past loved ones, and like he saw his family in the Mirror of Erised in book one, and I just always equated it with that. As for Neville, I just always thought that Neville's fight or flight is a little stronger, so he didn't even bother going down to the dais, even if he felt tempted in any way. But Luna would naturally be curious. She has a natural curiosity, where Neville's a little more protective of his curiosity.
Yeah, he's like, I could probably stay back here.
I don't blame him.
You guys let me know what you hear/see. I'll catch up with you later.
I'll just be here by the doorway in case we need to escape.
I did also, like related to the Thestral thing, but then you're right, like, why didn't Neville? And it's probably what Danny says. He's probably like back there, like, hey, just let me know when you're good, I'm good.
Well, he's always drawn to his family, which he never knew.
Right.
So what voices would draw him? Those that sound familiar to him, which would be essentially his family. Whereas Luna, who lost her mother, grew up with her mom, so still has that connection, but maybe not that pull of, I want this because I've never had this.
Yeah, and I think I would buy it if the voices are either like Harry's like past relatives or anything like that, because that's really the only equivalent where I would be like, okay, so maybe he would mistake it for someone who sounds like Sirius, right? Or someone who sounds like Ron. Because if they were just strangers, I don't think he would make that mistake, you know, because that's like,
right,
his best friend and his godfather. Like, those are voices he's not gonna like get confused hearing and being like, who's that? Like, he's gonna know. But I think it's so interesting that, like, we do see this and we like experience this room in this moment before they head off to other rooms, and then we come back here to see it again and get sort of the payoff of, like, you know, we're so curious about this veil and what it does and why it's constantly moving, and then we actually see it in action.
Is it like foreshadowing, like, maybe you think you can hear them because that's what's going to be through there soon?
I like that idea, like, as horrible as it is to say, to be like, I like, you know, the fact that we get to torture Harry a little bit more, but it would make sense, right, for him to like think he hears Sirius on the other side of that, and it's like, yeah, like the veil, I would bet the veil knows exactly who's gonna come through it at any time, you know. And I also, like, I spoke about the veil at my panel at LeakyCon last year, and one of my theories about how it's like constant, because it's constantly moving, is like, speaks to the fact that like death is always happening, right? Like, someone somewhere is like having their veil, like walking through the veil at any type. and how we see when Sirius goes through it, it's this big jarring moment for us. And yet the veil is like, okay, who's next? Like who's the veil next? Just, yeah. The veil just like falls back into place and it's ready for whoever's going to come through next. So, but if we think about this room, what do we think the Department of Mysteries does with this room?
Do we believe that the arch and the veil was created or like found? Because if it's a found object, the ministry might be like, this can't be out in the world. We got to do something about this. Like, we can't just have this veil that children wander through and then poof.
Poof.
I think that's a great point. And this like reminds me of an old Pottercast episode where they were talking about the Department of Mysteries, and they were talking about whether or not the veil already existed in that spot and was the ministry built over it, versus if it was created or not. I also like the idea of like, if it was elsewhere, were they able to transport it here? Did they happen upon it while they were building the ministry however long ago? And then also like, are they studying death? Are they, or is this just a room to like keep it safe so no one just wanders through it? You know,
I mean, Harry almost walks through it, right? Because he really wants to get to the other side. He's like, what? I need to know what this is.
It might just be a protected space, because I feel like it might be one of those items where we're like, oh, this might be a little too big to study, because it just draws people in. Or maybe they study who it draws in and who doesn't and kind of study it that way.
It makes sense that the ministry is like built on top of like some type of ruin or something.
Yeah.
And they were like, let's just lock this up. Sure, we found it, whatever. Let's just close it up. Nobody needs to know about it.
But what's interesting though is that if that room is so dangerous because the veil like beckons people in and through, why is that not the room? Why is that not room three that's completely locked? Alohomora doesn't work and it ruins Sirius's knife. Like, what's behind door number three? If it's something that they're like, absolutely no one can come in here.
It's the other side of the veil.
I like that.
Could be. It's like them. I don't know.
Like, the veil is only dangerous if you go through it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the locked room is inherently dangerous that even walking through the door and you're just fried.
Okay. I like that too.
Or they were like testing things and made something angry and now they're just like, we're good.
Let's just close this door.
Can't do anything here. We're gonna lock this one down. We can't.
I do like that too, because I would totally buy that for the Department of Mysteries as well, because like whatever they're doing, I'm sure something has had to have gone wrong at some point, right? And then they're just like, here is a permanent sealing charm on this door. No one's going to get in.
I wonder if that means there's rooms out there that at one time they had things that they believed to be dangerous that through like Newt's commander studying creatures, it's like, these actually aren't dangerous and we can release these from these rooms because just at this time period you believed these things were not.
Yeah, it's just so interesting because I feel like the wizarding world is just full of dangerous shit. So what is so bad that they're like, no, we're gonna lock this, you know, behind this door. Nobody can get in this like secret department that we have that like we cannot confirm or deny whether it exists. But
aliens, magical aliens. Area 51.
It's Area 51. this was the break-in to Area 51 in the wizarding world. There's aliens behind that door, but you know what? You can have a three-headed dog in a school with children. We'll allow you to put dementors in a school with children. We'll have moving staircases.
I mean, giving an 11-year-old a magic wand is dangerous in of itself. Have you met some 11-year-olds? I don't know if I'm giving them magic wands. How are there not more children missing limbs in Hogwarts?
Well, especially since Neville was, tossed out a window.
Don't even get me started on that. I still can't believe that.
I know.
Let's see if he's magic.
Boom. Thank God he was. So, room 4 is the time room. It's the correct one from Harry's dream. There are clocks everywhere. Everything's ticking. There's a crystal bell jar as tall as Harry with a glittering wind within it. And a hummingbird is inside it, and it seems to be in a cycle of being trapped in the jar. We also have part of the fight go down in here. I think it's probably pretty evident that this is probably where they developed a time turner. My big question that occurred to me during the fight with the Death Eaters is that the Death Eater whose head falls into it, when his head turns into a baby, does his brain also change into a baby?
That, let me tell you that I must have erased that part from my brain, because when I was reading this now, I was like, what is this? what is that? And he just kept showing up. I was like, how's this baby making it around? I've had 3 babies. Why is this guy walking around
I know, because I'm like, his head definitely seems to be baby form, but the rest and of him brain. Is an adult.
To me, his brain is not, because he's
Yeah, he's still moving around and knows enough to still attack Harry even when he has his baby head.
It's weird. I'm so glad they didn't put that in the movie.
The thing I hate most and that creeps me out the most is not spiders. It's movies where they have babies that talk like adults and do weird things with babies talking. And every time I read this part, it makes me think of creepy baby adult things.
But clearly Breaking Dawn is not for you.
Or for me.
That one wasn't as bad. It's when they do these like that cartoon with Boss Baby, it Boss freaks Baby. Me out. It's very concerning to me.
Oh, I love Boss Baby.
So maybe his brain is like a child's baby's, but his body is still responding to the directions it was given from the adult brain. Because if it's if his brain was still working, he would go back to that thing, put your head in, and wait until you're an adult again, and then pull your head out.
Because he's stuck in the cycle, right? So his head is going from baby to adult, baby to adult. So I'm wondering if when he's in adult form, he gets a flash of what he's supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
For a second, and then he loses it, and then.
But his body's already doing the thing.
Yeah.
I would go with that. That feels believable.
Maybe it's just men. It's explaining men.
That's it. Yep.
This is men.
I love that.
But when I read it, I was like, this is so ridiculous. And it kept coming up. I was like, this baby's still here?
I know. We spend a lot more time on that Death Eater than we do a bunch of the other ones.
Yeah. I was like, what is this?
Why haven't we just stupefied him yet?
Yeah, I was what is happening?
Baby Death Eater, then Hermione's you can't hurt a baby. And it's that's not a baby. That is a Death Eater. And you can totally hurt it. It's fine. This is a life or death situation, Hermione.
We are about to die.
Yes.
At the hands of a baby.
Crazy.
So, never a dull moment in the Department of Mysteries, truly.
No. The whole thing. I was thinking oh my God, how did I not remember? I definitely did not remember the baby thing. I was what is this?
So the next room that we see has a bunch of planets in there. We don't actually like see it. We hear about it from Luna.
Yeah.
A bunch of planets make sense. They do study astronomy. I'm pretty sure Dumbledore has a watch that has like a bunch of planets in there. But Luna says that some of the time they were floating in the dark. So it's not just a room that you just like casually walk through. You like actually like it lifted
there's
off,
like no
off
gravity.
The ground. Yeah.
Anti-gravity.
Yeah.
The room I would have loved to see. That's my jam.
Yeah. So like I feel like this is like the one room that I'm like, okay, this makes sense for like something you would study. Time also makes sense. So we at least know of like four possible things that like are that may be studied in the Department of Mysteries, which is a very interesting insight into the wizarding world and like the ministry and like what they deem important. And then after that, our final room is the room with the prophecies. And what do we think is the significance of the fact that the room, the prophecy room, is just off of the time room? It's not like its own door. You have to go through the time room in order to get to the prophecy room.
Well, it's like, it would be an, I think it'd be an extended study on time because you never know when a prophecy is going to come true. And so when you're studying time and it's like, especially like if the time turners are created and you want to see like how prophecy came to be, the time turner is the perfect way to like study the prophecy even further. So because you can't touch, you don't know what it says unless someone touches it, but once it happens, you can now do the research on that prophecy and like study the, or even go back to the initial prophecy. So like maybe they didn't have all the prophecies recorded, but someone could like time turn her back and be like, this, we know this prophecy is
theoretically
happening.
Depends on how far back, because technically in this text there's only so far back you can go, I believe, for the time turner.
But how did we discover that things go wrong with wizards that mess with time?
I mean, yes.
This is how. The department mystery is how we know that things
actually
go wrong.
I will buy that. I will buy, because I'm pretty sure there's extra canon. This is not a spoiler at all, that like there was a witch who went back super far with the time turner, but like either like I think when she came forward, she had like aged all of that time, because you do have to relive the time forward that you go.
Isn't that like something like that? She also like wiped out part of her line or something because she messed with something.
Probably, yeah. I think that sounds right. So yes, I would buy that's where that fuck up happened.
I have a question.
Yes.
So the prophecies can only be retrieved by the person that it's about.
Yes.
Right? Who's placing these prophecies in there?
It's an excellent question.
Like, how are they getting here?
Or do they just appear? Like,
I know. We don't know if they appear or not. We also, I don't, my other question was, is that, is there, so like the only written record we really have is like the initials of like, this person told the prophecy to this person and it's about these two people. Once a prophecy is broken, which they smash a whole bunch of them in these chapters, if no one's around to hear it or write it down, there's no written record of that, I'm assuming. So is that, do we just not know what prophecies are out there anymore? Does it affect whether or not they come true if it technically doesn't exist?
I don't think it would affect if it comes true or not, because you don't need it written down. We just don't know that it comes true. Maybe the prophecies are like some pensive magic. Like the person, because you get it from the person that has heard it, mm-hmm. or has said it. So like, mm-hmm. and Dumbledore knows what the prophecy said because he was given firsthand information. So did like Dumbledore create that prophecy and give it to the ministry? Also, are there all these prophecies out there just floating because people don't want to tell the ministry?
And also, my other thing is like, how would you know if you had a prophecy written about? Like, does the ministry call you? Like, hey.
Ring, ring.
We have a prophecy that just appeared, and it has your name on it. If you want to come down to the Department of Mysteries and like come pick it up and hear it. I think they filled
that in because Harry's had question marks, right?
Yes. And then there were initially question marks, and then Harry's name is written beside it. So
until they know who it's about, or like, there must be someone that is in control that has access to know, that would have to fill in that information of like, oh, we know this is about Voldemort, but we don't know who this is. And then as soon as he took action, which shows who it was about, they could then fill in this name. So someone in the ministry that's working these has to know what the actual prophecy says and not necessarily the person that touches it. So maybe people in the Department of Mysteries enchant them so that, and then they would be able to place them because they would have to be updating these things as prophecies start happening.
Right.
Because it could be hundreds, thousands of years before a prophecy comes to pass.
Yeah, I would expect.
Sounds like a data entry nightmare.
I truly.
I would hate that job.
Like, there's just, because there's no, like, record of anything. Like, I'm sure whoever, like, showed up for work, like, you know, the following day after these events at the Department of Mysteries and just finds all of these prophecies smashed. It's like, oh, God damn it. Like.
But could you imagine being the gossip from the ministry who watches a prophecy and then be like, Janet, I got the tea for you. You want to know what happened yesterday?
You're not going to believe this one.
Dude attacked a baby. A baby. And lost.
And the security guard was sleeping on the job.
Yeah. Okay, one of the things that I also wanted to talk about as far as prophecies go is that we find Harry's prophecy on row 97. Because I'm me, I was like, oh, I wonder what 97 means. Beside the fact that that was when Harry Potter was first published, which checks out if that's why it was chosen, fine. But if we look at numerology, the number 9 is a very powerful number, and it represents the completion of a cycle of some kind of chapter. It is also like has skillful characteristics stemming from amazing feats of accomplishment. It also represents struggles and roadblocks and having the wisdom and strength to overcome them. The number 7 represents logic, understanding, intellect. Usually people want to uncover the truth and understand how the world works. 7 also connects to a lot of things, like there are 7 classical planets. There are 7 notes in a scale. It's just the epitome of completeness. And we also can't forget that Harry was born in the 7th month of the year. So I thought this was like a really interesting call out. Because I would argue that these two chapters, there is a end of a chapter for Harry. And I also think while we may associate intellect and logic with Hermione, Harry is very curious about things. And like, when he gets his mind set on like figuring out what is happening, like there's no stopping him as we've seen in these chapters.
I can get behind that. And we also know throughout this book, numbers are important and locations are important.
Yep.
But it makes me wonder now if like, is how they're labeled within the ministry a way of like, is this the bad wizards are involved section and things will happen? This is the chosen one section. Like,
that's true. What is the card catalog for the Room of Prophecies?
Because like in all the years, I don't think that prophecy would have, like, it's relatively recent compared to wizards. There's no way they're only on row 97 by the time they get to Harry. And
that's then a do good they point. Like
just restart from the beginning and fill in empty gaps?
Well, they have a bunch of empty gaps now that
restore it all.
Because the other thing like with the prophecies is that we see that like it's mentioned that some have like a weird glow to them and other ones are dull and dark within as blown light bulbs, it's described as. Do we think the ones that are dull are the ones that have been completed?
Or the person died and never.
Yeah. Or is it if it went, if it words, is it what happens when prophecies don't come true? And then that's my other question. Do they always come true? Or is, I mean, this is a fate versus free will kind of argument, right? Like, which one exists in the wizarding world?
Or is it also that those dimmer ones, the people that are involved in it, are not yet born, and so there is no light to follow because the people have not entered the planet yet? Because, like, when they die, I don't necessarily go with that one because eventually they're all going to die. So is there, like, another row of just, like, unlit prophecies that is just, like, oh, these are have come to pass? Because I feel like from when we read it, are there thing not necessarily things that have passed yet.
Mm-hmm.
That we see in the room. So maybe they're just ones that are just like in limbo. Like they have been spoken about, but they are not ready to, they're not in the era of it taking part.
I like the, like, not, oh, what is that book series? Born thing.
Yeah, I like that too.
It's a prophecy book. And at, when the prophecy starts to happen, the words in the book change color.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, it's a good book series too. I think it's about dragons.
Dragons.
I'm into it. I'm sold.
Sold. I'll figure out what it is. But this book has like prophecies, and as they start to come to happen, the color of the writing changes within the prophecy.
That's fun. I would buy that.
The Dragonian series, I think. Yeah, it's the Dragonian series. Because there's a prophecy about one, and until something happens to the other character who it's about, until she, like, starts moving on that path, it doesn't change.
That's really cool.
That's cool.
Okay, so, as we know, Harry's very sassy. And it super comes out as soon as we deal with the Death Eaters. Harry wastes no time. I did enjoy the fact that at the end of this first of two chapters that we're discussing, it's not explicitly named that it is Lucius Malfoy who speaks at the end of that chapter until the beginning of the following chapter. But we kind of know it's him because the word drawling is used to describe him talk, and that is very much a word that we associate with Draco from day one. So I did like that identification of that character without really having to like actually explain it. We finally, this is something I have been wondering about since I started this podcast, is whether or not the Death Eaters already knew that Voldemort was a half-blood or not, and why it didn't matter to them if they did know. But Harry tells them, and I'm curious as to, you know, whether or not they just found out in this moment of Harry telling them, why they don't really care. Like, are they just okay pushing it aside and taking orders from a half-blood because of what they stand to gain? And so they can kind of be hypocritical about it and be like, purebloods only, except for this guy who's going to give us what we want.
Since he is essentially a descendant of Salazar Slytherin, do you think they overlook it because of the stronger ties on one side of his family line?
It's a good question.
I don't think it's that deep. I think it's just you're in a cult and your cult leader told you to do this and you're going to do it. And now it's too late to back out without making you look like, damn, maybe I was wrong.
Without you being killed.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to die.
Yeah.
You're like, if he's a half, you know, what are we going to do? It is what it is.
You're 15. Do I believe you? You're a teenager trying to save your head right now.
Very true. The other thing that really made me laugh is that the Death Eaters are like beside themselves with like the fact that Dumbledore didn't tell Harry about the prophecy. Like they can't believe that Dumbledore would not tell Harry something. But we know as readers that Dumbledore doesn't tell Harry anything, literally ever.
Nothing.
Especially in this book.
Yeah. Nothing. There's no, and it's weird, right? Because like, even though he's not like telling him anything, you're like, why didn't he tell him?
Right? They like, they're so sure that like Harry, they're like, well, Harry has not like come to get this prophecy. Like, he is a curious dude. Like, as soon as Dumbledore told him about this, he would have come running. And then they're like, wait, he just like never told you.
You didn't even know?
You didn't know? Clearly there's more open lines of communication within the Death Eaters than there are in the Order of the Phoenix. It's fine.
Oh, man.
But we do get to see sort of the Dumbledore's army training pay off in real time as they go up against this group of Death Eaters. We also see wandless magic in this fight. I think for the first time, I don't think we've seen that before. And we also see that words do matter in magic. Like, obviously, if you're doing wandless magic, you are talented enough where it doesn't matter. But if you are a 15-year-old who is still learning, words do matter for magic, not just intention. Because when Neville tries to use stupefy, when his nose is broken, he's pronouncing it wrong, so it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see the different skill levels in these fights. Also, not to bring you into your feels, but Neville's wand breaks, and it is his dad's wand.
Dad's wand.
Which is so sad. But I also think his dad would be really proud that it broke in a duel with the Death Eaters.
I think the wand breaking is probably one of the best things that ever happened to Neville.
I mean, boy deserves like his own wand, yes.
Yes, it is his dad's wand, but he's been having that expectation to live up to his dad for his entire life and having that wand, that when he finally gets his own wand and he doesn't have that over him in a way, but in the background, he also knows that wand went out very strong and like would have made his dad proud.
It makes me sad that when it breaks, he's more concerned that his grandmother's going to be upset.
Yeah.
I'm like, Neville. Oh, Neville.
Grandmother is ruthless.
Yeah.
So following along with our feels, this fight eventually makes it back to the Veil Room, and the Order of the Phoenix come to save the day. Dumbledore arrives, and it finally seems like everything's going to be okay. But it's not. We lose Sirius in this huge, momentous moment. I think Cedric's death in book four was kind of like our first like big death as like, you know, readers, and kind of prepped us a little bit for this moment that was about to happen.
I didn't think it would happen, though.
You didn't?
I thought, no. I didn't understand why they did that. Like, I felt like it was, like, his only family member, and felt like it was unnecessary. That's just me. And I'm not, like, a huge lover of Harry. But I did feel, like, really bad. I didn't feel bad about Cedric.
But Paula, tell us more.
This one hurt me like a lot. So,
yeah. And like, I feel like this, because I think you're right. Like, I'm not entirely sure I understand what the reasoning was from a writing perspective to put Harry through this, besides to just make him suffer more. Right. You know, him not having his parents obviously is like what kickstarts the entire plot of this, right? I think Cedric's death was Harry's first real moment of, oh shit, Voldemort is back and these are what the consequences are going to be. And maybe this moment is that again, but on a bigger scale. You know, because it's almost like if this was the consequence of Harry not learning Occlumency, right? Or having to discover that he can't always trust these visions that he has from Voldemort. What a horribly cruel way to have Harry learn that lesson. Just horrific.
Feels unnecessary. I just... It feels super unnecessary, and I still say that it's that one's like the deaths in order. I'm not going to say them because we don't want to spoil anything, but that one is definitely, I would say, top two.
Yeah.
For sure.
Because it just sucks, because it's just like Harry has so much hope that he's going to like get out of the Dursleys when he first learns the truth about Sirius, and then that's ripped away because like he's technically not innocent like yet, right? Because he has to prove it.
Like, I get it, Cedric died, but also like Cedric was not a close friend.
Yep.
It was like in the peripheral, like you didn't really know him, you didn't know much about him, you were involved in the reason he died, mm-hmm. which I think that takes more of a toll than it being Cedric.
Mm-hmm.
And like this moment is almost, even like with other characters, this is like a moment where they really do go from being children to realizing they need to grow up and have like more adult responsibilities, in the sense of that they're going to war.
Yep.
Like the stakes are higher. It's not just about catching the teacher at the other end of the maze. Like there are real stakes and there are real consequences to those stakes. So it's almost like Neville's wand breaking has put him on another path. Harry losing Sirius puts him on this other path, and where things go from there.
I mean, I always say that this is my favorite book because it's where things get serious. but I feel like it's like when they're starting to like they're getting out of being kids, right? They're like these are like real adult problems. This is beyond adult problems, but you know, they're experiencing like death and these battles and fighting people. Like, this is getting real. This is no longer like, hey, I'm just trying to get the stone, you know, looking at my family in a mirror.
Yeah,
it's not well, and it's anymore.
It's also the first real battle that's not happening at Hogwarts. Yes. It's that it isn't just Hogwarts we are now protecting. We are out in the real world, and it's not just the school that is threatened.
Yes. Yeah, I think, you know, it's been a recurring theme in these books that they get darker and darker and darker. And you know, as Harry ages, you know, a lot of these problems that he faces become more complicated, right? You know, and so Harry was dealt a whole ton of trauma in book four that he like literally is working through PTSD in this book, right? And, you know, and I think you guys are right that it's like this is now a more serious problem for Harry to deal with.
Like, you don't want to say it, but you're like, you gotta.
Yeah. And now they are they're also on the other side of like their halfway point of Hogwarts, right? Like they are going to be adults in the Wizarding World very soon. And this is now a real world problem. And this is also a perfect example of like, if the ministry were doing their jobs, then maybe Voldemort would not have had such an easy time getting into the ministry to set up this whole plan in general. So the ministry has failed them. I think this is also a prime moment of adults failing Harry as well. You know, Dumbledore's silence since the beginning of this book, had things been explained to him, and like it not just being like, here, go take classes with this teacher that clearly hates your guts. Like that was really the only other adult like Harry had like interaction with, was Snape, while Umbridge is around the school this entire time. And so I think all of those failures kind of like read this situation in which now we're like in a real world situation of this is happening in the ministry and no one is safe. And also, you know, I think this also is highlights how dangerous, like, the wizarding world is right now. Because obviously we know, like, going up against Voldemort is dangerous, but we haven't actually seen any, like, real action like they did in the first Wizarding War. And Molly Weasley, like, we saw her bog art earlier in this book, and it was literally all of her entire family being dead. And, you know, people were kind of brushing it off of, like, no, it's safe, it's fine, we're going to be fine, everyone's going to be fine. Not everyone is going to be fine when you are fighting a fight like this. And to sort of, like, go along with all of this is, so with Sirius, we don't exactly know what spell he gets hit with. We know the previous spell that Bellatrix sent over to him was red. And then the second one that hits him, it just says a jet of light. So we don't know what color it is, which I found fascinating that it was not stated.
We think it's the spell?
That's my question. Do you think he's dead before he falls through the veil, or is he dead because he fell through the veil?
In my head, it was always that because he fell through the veil.
Same.
Yeah.
Not which to me brings it back to the fact that Harry wanted to go through it, and, like, how dangerous that could have been if he did.
Yes.
Right? If he just walks through it, he's dead. Like, so, I don't know. To me, it's he died because he fell through it.
So to tie all this together, we spoke on this podcast before in this book about doorways in general and how they are both a start of something and an end of something, because when you walk through a threshold, you're entering one place as you simultaneously exit another. These two chapters are full of doorways to different places in magic and within the ministry. It's also this door that Harry has dreamed about, which kicks all of these events into motion. And it started a new mystery of the prophecy and Harry learning about the prophecy. And it ended with Sirius falling through the veil, which I would argue an archway can be a doorway too. And he exits this world, and Harry will have to enter a new version of his life now without Sirius going forward. And so I think, like, this concept of entering and exiting is, like, huge in this book, and maybe, like, the overall symbol of Order of the Phoenix in general, because this is such a big moment for Harry. And, you know, we saw how he responded to Cedric's death, who, like you said, was not a very close friend, but was still a very traumatizing moment for Harry. And now we have this, who is someone that Harry deeply cares about and loves and was, like, a beacon of light and, like, the only person he really considered family, right? Left. And so now we have another doorway that Harry has crossed through, unfortunately.
Again, right? Because Lex is, like, without his parents.
Yeah.
He witnesses an acquaintance die, and now his godfather, who he had, like, these, like, dreams, you know, that, I'm going to get out of this awful house.
Yeah.
Now, just like Sirius, it's gone.
It's Harry goes through so much, this poor boy.
He does, and I also feel that Harry forgets that family, it does not just mean blood relations. I think sometimes he takes for granted the family that he has found.
He's learning that still, because yes,
he's still learning that.
Only a chapter and a half ago was he like, I don't want these guys to come with me.
Like, he's definitely still learning who his family is, and that he doesn't have to be physically blood related to have those people be family. He connected with Sirius as his godfather, but he didn't connect with Lupin in the same way because he doesn't have the title.
You think he's elitist?
I don't think it's elitist, but like
he's like only you don't have a title. I'm sorry.
If anything, Harry spent more time with Lupin than he did.
He did, Sirius. But Sirius has the advantage of reminding Harry of his father.
Yes, he does, and that he was his father's best friend, and like there's and a lot that goes into that too. Him
yeah, as yeah. his godparents. So
yeah,
I think that says something.
No, I think it says something too. But there's another best friend out there that is also family that he just kind of was like.
Yeah, that cares about Harry just as much as Sirius does.
To I'm the sure. point that he just watched his best friend go through the veil and he's protecting Harry.
Yeah.
Because he was there too, watching someone he thought had murdered their best friends die. But has to protect Harry before his own.
Poor
emotions.
Lupin, man. Come on.
Like, can you
poor
imagine?
Harry,
like...
Poor Lupin. No, yeah. I can't. Especially to like live like half your life like thinking your best friend like actually betrayed your other best friends, and then only and to then find out that wasn't true. And yeah, and you get him back for like 2 years, and then he's gone.
And again. You can't worry about yourself anymore. You have to worry about the kid that you know is going to go after him because
yeah,
that's what
he who
does.
Will literally walk through the veil after Sirius. Yeah.
Yeah. Foreshadowing in that at the beginning when that he really like wants to walk through it.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I'll tell you what, when I read this, like now, I cried the first time I read it, and then I read it and I was like, that last, there's nothing you can do, Harry. Nothing. He's gone. I was like, oh my God. Again.
I know.
Why did you do this to
I don't think I cried the
us?
First time.
You didn't?
I remember
prior. So, well, not only that, no, but remember that I was already an adult.
Yeah. I was angry. I remember being very, it was like the first time I really was angry at a book. Like, I was... And I probably was like upset in the crying sort of way, but my anger won out because Sirius was one of my favorite characters. And I was so excited that he came back in this book. You know, I was all for it. And then he got taken away. I was like so angry about it.
Yeah, no, I 100% cried.
It's so sad. I mean, Harry really, I think, has felt so helpless in this book anyway. And then this is just another thing that he can't change. Like, he really tried to like take initiative, and like he's like, I'm gonna save Sirius, and ultimately is the reason that Sirius died, which is horrible.
I can't believe you made us live through this again.
Sorry to re-traumatize you.
I know, like
next time we want a happy chapter.
That's
next time. Yeah, requesting it's probably hard to find. But
yeah, from this point forward, again, things just get darker.
Maybe you should have just had us on at the beat, you know, when you first started. You know, you might have found a happy chapter in there yeah. somewhere. But
I'm sure
now
I can find one.
We're screwed. There's nothing. After this, it's over.
It's all downhill from here, readers.
It's all downhill from here. Yeah. I just. Even with the movies, I forgot how dark they got. I was watching them with Jude. Jude was probably like 6. And when we watched Goblet of Fire, it comes again, because I have like this disconnect with Cedric Diggory. I didn't think it would affect him the way it did. And he like lost it. Like, he was upset for months. I was like, I'm about to disown you, kid. Relax. Anyway. But yeah, I had forgotten how dark the stories get as, you know, as they get older.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you guys re-traumatizing yourselves to be on this podcast.
Anything for you, Sarah.
True friendship right here.
Right, we'll find a way to traumatize you back. It's okay.
Yes,
that's
fair. We'll start thinking about it right now. Unbelievable.
Well, thank you guys for joining me. Do you guys have any plans in the works? Anything that you want to shout out?
We can shout out for our Leaky Congoers that all three of us are going to be on the same panel together. Yay! With some other podcasters.
So exciting.
So if you will be in Chicago, August
4th through 6th.
I keep thinking of my travel dates and not LeakyCon dates.
We don't have
a date or time, but we will share that information as it gets scheduled.
Yes, we will. I'll be on a podcasting panel together, and I have two other panels that I will be doing, and I'm very excited about it.
Can you talk about it or not yet?
Yeah, I'm doing Death as a Symbol in Harry Potter again.
Okay, I like that one.
And then, thank you. And then I am also doing the unsung heroes of your favorite series. So all of the side characters that totally help the hero get to where they need to be, but get zero credit for it. We're gonna chat about the importance of those characters and also open it up so that the audience can share characters that they want to celebrate and honor.
I like that.
I'm very excited.
Paula and I also have Confidence Through Cosplay panel. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a Pottergram meetup for all the Pottergrammers out there to meet each other in a safe space.
Yes.
And we're also doing, again, it's called Bienvenido a la Magia, which is a meetup for fandom lovers from the Latin and Hispanic community, it was like one of my favorite moments in Denver. So I'm very excited that we got that again. I'm excited you guys are doing it again. Yeah, it was awesome.
Yay.
Yeah, we'll get all the schedules posted once we have all the
information. Once we know. Hopefully we'll get it soon.
Fingers crossed. We're in the final countdown.
Yeah, tell my cosplay that.
Listen, I have a list of things I need to buy.
What cosplay? I don't even have one.
You just decided you're going to be the phone
booth. You're going to be the phone booth? You have to do Dedrick again?
I could do Dedrick. I'll probably do Dedrick like maybe Sunday. I don't know. I'm doing a Hobbit. We're doing Hobbits on Friday. So. Okay.
Did I tell you that, Sarah?
You did tell me that. I'm probably not going to do a Hobbit, but I will do an elf, I think.
Yeah, you're
okay.
You have an elf vibe.
I do.
I don't even know what being a hobbit. I know they like potatoes on second breakfast. That's not, I don't know.
Food, gardening, good Hufflepuff. Good times is literally all hobbit
Hufflepuff.
Life.
Hufflepuff.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So I still have to come up with what I'm wearing for that. Yeah. And if I do the phone booth, I have to see how I can do that. It seems uncomfortable to walk around dressed as a phone booth all day.
You could just like wear it for like the first like hour on like Saturday and then just hand out a bunch of pins.
There you go.
Like as people are checking in. Just
like here, push my button right here.
Maybe not.
That'd be so great.
Maybe not.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for joining me. Yes, anytime. First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming to everybody.